Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting live for the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands and of the Mohican people, not knowing as Stockbridge Muniz community. I'm Dulcinea Diggs.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Dunley's recap of a rally in Albany in support of the Cuban Revolution. Then Corinne Carey brings us to another rally from the past weekend, Save Our Services rally in downtown Schenectady. Later on, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry interviews Mark Animation, director of the Capital District Area Labor Federation. After that, I will be speaking with one of the new Nature Lab Community Service coordinators, Devin Robinson. And finally, Lizzie Kramer spoke with muralist Liz Zunan about her latest piece, which is at the Blake Annex co-writing space in downtown Albany. But first, here are the headlines.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said that New York State must stop dragging its heels and release more than $2 billion in federal funding meant to help desperate renters pay their bills. Otherwise, the feds may take the money back. The statewide freeze on evictions comes to an end on August 31st. And advocates who have had little luck pushing lawmakers to once again extend the new streamlined application process.
Governor Cuomo, who has viewed as the major reason for the long delay in New York's legalization of marijuana, is now blocking the implementation of the new law by failing to appoint individuals to key management positions. He apparently is using his holdout on implementation to gain leverage over the efforts to change how the MTA is overseen.
The city of Albany's 10th and 11th homicides of 2021 came over the recent weekend. On Friday, the mayor made a state of emergency declaration. One of her first actions was the shutdown of a Lark Street bar, Cafe Hollywood, that appears to have been connected to Friday's killing, though the owner denies it. The state of emergency eliminates the need for a notice and a public hearing to close a business declared to be a public safety nuisance.
A dozen speakers spoke at a rally Sunday hosted by Schenectady Coalition for Healthcare Access in downtown Schenectady on Sunday to highlight concerns surrounding the proposed merger of Schenectady-based Ellis Medicine and St. Peter's Health Partners, an Albany-based company that is now owned by nationwide corporation Trinity Health. Speakers were especially worried that the possible loss of access to reproductive health care services, and we have a story on that later.
About a sixth of the 184,000 criminal cases that went before a judge in New York in 2020 led to the person being rearrested before the case concluded, according to new data from the state's court system. State Republicans are continuing to push to roll back bail reform, contending that it has led to an increase in gun violence.
The Times Union reports that Republicans expressed outrage on Friday that the U.S. Department of Justice will not open a civil rights investigation into the policies by New York and several other states that spurred nursing homes to take in residents who were being discharged from hospitals but still testing positive for COVID-19. However, there is still the federal investigation by the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office into whether the Cuomo administration intentionally covered up data on nursing home deaths. That's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Like what you hear? Find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
On Sunday, July 26, various socialists, peace and green groups held a rally at Townsend Park in Albany in support of the Cuban Revolution. We hear from John Kressler of Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace and Mabel Leon of Schenectady by Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
My name is Kirk Winans. I'm the chair of the Capital District Socialist Party. I will be your comrade of ceremonies today. We have a number of speakers up today to talk about Cuba, the revolution, the U.S. blockade, and sanctions. And of course, this is a rally to talk about ending such blockade and sanctions and normalizing U.S.-Cuba relations, ending the suffering that the U.S. or Gaslight Empire is inflicting on the Cuban people just because we don't like their regime, or our government doesn't. I have John Cothin from Bethlehem Neighbors of Peace.
John read an open letter signed by a number of progressives calling upon President Biden to end the blockade of Cuba.
And it goes, President Joseph Biden, it is time to take a new path forward in U.S.-Cuban relations. Are making this urgent public appeal to you to reject the cruel policies put into place by the Trump White House that have created so much suffering among the Cuban people. Cuba, a country of 11 million people. How many people are there in New York State? More than that. Cuba, a country of 11 million people, is living through a difficult crisis due to the growing scarcity of food and medicine. Recent protests have drawn the world's attention to this. While the COVID-19 pandemic has proven challenging for all countries, it has been even more so for a small island under the weight of an economic embargo. We find it unconscionable, especially during a pandemic, to intentionally block the remittances and Cuba's use of global financial institutions, given that access to dollars is necessary for the importation of food and medicine. We're blocking their access to food and medicine. A country that sends doctors all over the world, a country that sends medical supplies when we have hurricanes in the south to help us, we're blocking their access to medicine. As the pandemic struck the island, its people and their government lost billions in revenue from international tourism that would normally go to their public health care system, food distribution, and economic relief. During the pandemic, Donald Trump's administration tightened the embargo, pushed aside the Obama opening, and put in place 243 so-called coercive measures that have intentionally throttled life on the island and created more suffering. The prohibition on remittances, that's the money that the people outside Cuba are sending back to Cuba. The prohibition on remittances and the end of direct commercial flights between the U.S. and Cuba are impediments to the well-being of a majority of Cuban families. President Biden, you wrote on July 12th, quote, "We stand with the Cuban people," unquote. If that is the case, we ask you to immediately sign an executive order and annul Trump's 243 coercive measures. There is no reason to maintain the Cold War politics that required the U.S. to treat Cuba as an existential enemy rather than a neighbor. Instead of maintaining the path set by Trump in his efforts to undo President Obama's opening to Cuba, we call on you to move forward. Resume the opening, the Obama opening, and begin the process of ending the embargo. Ending the severe shortages of food and medicine must be top priority. On the 23rd of June, most of the member states of the United Nations, thank you, ask the U.S. to end the embargo. That was the entire General Assembly except for the United States and Israel. All the rest voted to end the embargo. For the past 30 years, this has been the consistent position of the majority of member states of the U.N. In addition, the UN wrote a letter to the U.S. government in April regarding the sanctions on Cuba. In the pandemic emergency, they wrote, "The lack of will of the U.S. government to suspend sanctions must lead to a higher risk of suffering in Cuba." We ask you, to end the Trump coercive measures and return to the Obama opening, or even better, begin the process of ending the embargo and fully normalizing relations between the United States.
We next hear from Mabel Leon, a Schenectady resident with Albany Cuba Solidarity and Pastors for Peace.
Some of our members from Albany Cuba Solidarity are not here today because they're in Washington, D.C. They're in Washington, D.C. greeting people, Cuban Americans, who have walked from Miami to Washington, D.C., with a petition calling for an end to the embargo. I have been appalled listening to our press and listening to our president, who I voted for, President Biden called Cuba a failed state. A failed state because it's communist. A failed state, that provides free health care to all its citizens. A failed state that provides free education to all its citizens. Proof is in the pudding when you look at health indicators. There is longer longevity in Cuba than there is in the richest nation in the world, the United States. They have a much lower rate of infant mortality than we do, particularly if you look at areas where poor people are, the country or inner cities, where the rate of infant mortality is horrendous. It is quite low in Cuba. That is a result of their healthcare system for all. The current situation in Cuba needs to be put in context. There is a COVID crisis, a global economic crisis, and Cuba has been suffering. It depends a great deal on tourism, which you have heard from other speakers, and that has been cut off with COVID. And the embargo has a stranglehold. Cuba does not export violence, to pick up on John's issue. Cuba does not violate the security of other nations. Cuba exports healing. Cuba exports doctors and sends more doctors around the world than the UN. When there was an Ebola crisis, the United States was busy building facilities. By the time they completed those facilities, the Ebola crisis was over. What did Cuba do? It sent health practitioners on the ground. They have done that over and over and over again. Is Cuba a threat? No. Cuba, we need Cuba. Right. Now, gonna talk a little bit. People have talked about, Obama loosened things. He allowed people to talk. He didn't eliminate the embargo. And they did not really end up making capital. They restrict all the capital that goes to Cuba. You can't run a country if you don't have access to capital or loans. And Cuba is restricted from that. Now, that has been intensified under Trump and continued under Biden. In addition, Trump, you've heard people talk about remittances. Those remittances are a lifeline for the Cuban people, from the people in the United States. Those have been severely limited. There was a restriction made that Americans could not stay at hotels if the government was involved. Cuba has a policy of owning 50% of all hotels and economic endeavors because they don't want it to turn into a capitalist country. Essentially, tourists are banned from going to hotels. Obviously, the embargo, it has collectively punished the Cuban people. And that is unacceptable and must be eliminated. So we have several jobs. The first job is for us not only to come to demonstrations, but to contact all our Congress people and to articulate end the embargo. Secondly, we can do something concrete. Pastors for Peace has this campaign to raise money for medicine, which they're going to buy wholesale and take to Cuba.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was a recap of Sunday's rally in support of the Cuban Revolution by Mark Dunley. And we heard from John Kessler of Bethlehem Neighbors of Peace, Mabel Leon of Schenectady, and others.
Another rally that took place last weekend was the Save Our Services rally, where people demand answers from hospital administrators involved in talks about the proposed merger between Ellis Hospital and Trinity Health. HMM correspondent Corinne Carey was there and reports from the rally.
On Sunday, July 25th, the Schenectady Healthcare Access Coalition held a rally in Veterans Memorial Park in downtown Schenectady. The rally was emceed by local community activist Nikita Hardy and the executive director of Schenectady's Human Rights Commission, Arthur Butler. Nikita Hardy outlined the concerns at the beginning of the rally.
There is a merger that's between Ellis and Trinity Health that was announced last October. Who is Trinity Health, do you ask? A massive healthcare system headquartered in Michigan with over 90 hospitals across the nation. St. Peter's in Albany is a Trinity hospital. Since then, Ellis has cut services, the visiting nurses service, the dental program, and they outsourced the emergency department. And now they plan to have the whole place managed by St. Peter's. All of this was done without community input or transparency, which brings us here today. We have questions, lots of questions, and we deserve answers.
The Reverend Nicole D. Harris, pastor of Duryea Memorial AME Zion Church and the president of the local NAACP, was one of the first speakers.
This merger is a business decision. So a couple of these meetings happen on some conference calls or Zoom or webinar or whatever, you know, WebEx, whatever. Maybe sometimes they flew in. Maybe these meetings happen in the conference offices or the board offices at the hospital in a small room with people with suits on who made decisions about our health. We understand that business is a part of the healthcare system. So we understand that this merger is a business move, but I'm asking Ellis not to just make business moves, I'm asking you to make community moves.
Come on.
Because these meetings don't just need to happen in boardrooms, they need to happen in church basements, they need to happen in the community rooms at the shelter, they need to happen on the street corner. These meetings need to happen in your backyard, these meetings need to happen at the NAACP meetings, these meetings need to happen over at SICM. These meetings need to happen with transparency where you and I can attend and where we can hear what's going on. Because when you close the door and you're in the boardroom, there's no guarantee that somebody's behind that door that represents me. And no offense to anybody who wears nice suits here today, but I don't need anybody in a nice suit and tie making decisions for me. If you invite me into the room, I may be able to give you a perspective that you're not familiar with. If you invite me into the room, I'll tell you what I deal with from day to day. If you invite me into the room, I will tell you that I do not want to be further marginalized. And that by removing services, that is what you are doing. So how is it that we're removing services when we know, the disparities that already exist? When we know that if you want to go to debt in this country, just get sick. There are decisions that are being made in spaces where you and I are not. And that needs to change. So I want to encourage you today, but not to be silent until we get into those rooms. Or better yet, until those people in those rooms come to this park. Thank you so much.
I spoke with a number of the attendees. Here are their voices.
My name is Jennifer Gunderman. I'm a registered nurse currently at Bellevue Women's Center, which is part of Ellis here in Schenectady. Been a nurse for over 30 years. I've been here.
What concerns you about the merger between Ellis and Trinity?
Ellis right now is the only hospital serving not only Schenectady County, but many outlying and surrounding counties. An affiliation with Trinity, I'm afraid, is going to have a very negative impact on reproductive health care in this area and access to reproductive health care.
Have you seen the impact of the merger talks already, or is this something that you're anticipating?
We've seen some impact. There has been certain people, I believe, from the Trinity organization coming into Ellis now. It's all very secretive, and there's no real communication between the Ellis administration and its staff as far as what is going on. So it is leaving a lot of us wondering and guessing about what's going to happen.
What do you want from Ellis and from Trinity right now?
Reassurances in writing that reproductive health care will be protected in Schenectady County. As far as promises, that is fine, but having the written policies there, I think will protect the people in Schenectady County and protect their services, not just even in reproductive health care, but in many other facets that can be affected by a merger like this with hospitals with restrictive policies.
My name is Amaury Tañón Santos. I serve as the Chief Executive Officer at Schenectady Community Ministries. Our interfaith collaborative of over the 5 decades have been dealing with issues of poverty around food particularly, but health is one of those things. Ellis has been a significant partner in town for many, many years. And our concern is that, you know, all this talk about merging has all of a sudden disengaged with the community. And we need to make sure that the only hospital in town, the hospital that everybody in the community has learned to rely on for women's health and for emergency services, and as a significant community partner, we don't lose that. And we just want to make sure that everything is made transparently and that the community is engaged with and that we know what we're going to end up with. If merging with Trinity means that we're going to become a part of a larger medical system that's going to allow us access to services and opportunities and research that we don't have access to, great. If it means that we're going to lose access to our community-based health system, then we have the big issues, right? You know, people in this community depend on that. And it being the only hospital in town, we just need to make sure that everything is taken care of with the input of the community and with the community active in that health system, as it has been for decades.
Some people think that folks who come out to oppose the merger or to encourage talks between Ellis and the community are taking issue with a religious hospital. What's your feeling about this issue and religious freedom?
Well, as a faith person myself, I understand the concerns that people might have around realities or perceived realities around doctrine of any religious tradition, Christian or otherwise. I understand that there might be people that are concerned around what they think is Catholic doctrine. I'm not here to oppose it. I think most people that are going to be here are not here to oppose the merger. What we want to make sure is that because they're faith-based, we can have this broad conversation around what health means and how people want to receive it. And because this is the only hospital in town, because and probably in spite of the faith background of Trinity Health, we can make sure that everything gets the services that they need and that they deserve. Health is a right. And people have the right of say what they need and want in their health services.
Jamaica Miles, the reason I'm here today is because we already have health disparities in the city of Schenectady, and we can't afford for there to be a merger that may increase those disparities.
What concerns you most about this merger?
Part of it is the lack of transparency, that unfortunately this is commonplace, that there are conversations that will impact people's lives, and those very people may not even be aware that the conversations are being had. The other concern is that mergers that have happened with Trinity Health before have not been positive. There have been losses of jobs, there have been attacks on unions, there's been limitation or erasure of services that impact poor communities, LGBTQIA+. We can't have that happen here too.
I'm Linnell Engelmeyer. I'm one of the founding members of Progressive Schenectady, and I am here at the Save Our Services rally this afternoon because I care deeply about healthcare in Schenectady County, and particularly the loss of certain services that a merger with Trinity Healthcare could potentially bring. We don't want to stop this merger. We want there to be transparency in this merger, or potential merger. I know they've said right now that it just involves staff, but this is a same group that also told us that they weren't negotiating at all during COVID and in fact were. And so we care deeply about transparency. You know, some people are in a position where they can drive other places to get the health care that could potentially be missing, but a lot of people can't do that. And we want to preserve the health care in this area for all people.
What's the solution, do you think?
I think there are potential solutions. I don't know that I know the best one, but I do think it probably involves negotiating in good faith with all potential partners.
Throughout the day, you're going to hear our tagline, and that silence takes away our choices. Ellis, hear our voices. You want to try that with me? Silence takes away choices. Ellis, hear our voices.
My name is Justice Dazzle, and I came out to the rally today because I am a trans woman and I head up an organization, Schenectady Safe Space, that is working to open a Pride Center in Schenectady. And there are a lot of LGBTQIA plus people in this community that will potentially lose services. My partner is a cis woman, and if we decide to have a child, I want to be able to go to Bellevue and be treated with the same respect and dignity as any other couple.
I heard you talk about broken arm syndrome. Can you tell me what you meant by that?
Yeah, so broken arm syndrome is something, it's both with overweight people as well as trans people. When you go to a doctor or, you know, you're having this particular feeling, this numbness, this whatever that is going on in your life, in your health.
Like a broken arm.
Like a broken arm. That's something completely unrelated to someone's weight, something completely unrelated to someone's gender identity that then gets blamed and pointed that way. And in order to get them to do something, you either have to go to another provider, which isn't always an option for people because of their inability to have insurance or taking time off, all of those types of things. And they have to advocate for themselves. And especially in organizations that are ruled by outside forces that have made their health decisions for you. Sometimes it's all you can do, like as a trans person, being constantly misgendered and deadnamed to get up to that point that you just take what they give you and go on, and then you continue having that health problem.
Nikita Hardy closed the rally with a chant that participants had been using throughout the event.
Silence takes away choices.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey reporting from the Save Our Services rally.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dulcinea.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP, 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP, 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP, 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP, 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
The Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act, is once again in the U.S. Senate. This week, the AFL-CIO engages in the nationwide PRO Act Week of Action, focusing on in-person rallies in U.S. Senator state offices. In this labor segment, Roman labor correspondent Willie Terry interviews Mark Imontian, director of the Capital District Area Labor Federation, CDALF, on the meaning of PRO Act to labor.
500 new billionaires,
right,
in the United States since the pandemic started, and they're spending their money not hiring people, putting people back to work, building things that we need, child care centers and urgent care centers and housing that people can afford and fixing the schools and preparing for the next pandemic and fixing the internet, roads and bridges and all the stuff that people need to make a decent life. They're not doing that. Instead, what they're doing is they're taking their money that they basically stole from, you know, and they're running around spending $28 million to take a 7-minute ride in a spaceship.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not the only one, and you are not the only one angry about that, right, watching that. I see the pattern on, you know, television and stuff like that, and what working people are saying about this, and it's like, they're fed up.
Yes, especially Amazon.
Yeah. Oh, then the guy had the nerve yesterday saying to thank the Amazon workers who worked so hard that he could have the profits so he could fulfill his childhood dream of going to space. I wish he stayed in space.
All right, Mark. So in that PRO Act, is there provisions in that PRO Act that would protect workers who want to do organizing, you know, at the work site?
Yeah, so that's what this is supposed to be for, and exactly what you just said. Because if you say, okay, I'm sick of this, and I'm working at a local, let's say, grocery market that's anti-union around here, mm-hmm. and I'm sick of the way I'm being treated. We don't have guaranteed hours. We don't have guaranteed schedule. You know, that's really hard for working people. They're like, this week you got 10 hours, and next week you got 20 hours. This week you're working mornings, and next week you're working afternoons, and there's some notorious employers around here trying to do that. If you tried to organize a union amongst them, you're going to lose all of your hours. It's legal for you to organize a union and talk to your coworkers about this, but mm-hmm. they don't want you to do it. So those workers are harassed. Their hours are cut. They're slashed. They're all sorts of things, and even worse, they're fired. They have trumped up charges and all sorts of other things that happen to workers in that situation. We saw when we were trying to organize McDonald's around here how difficult it was to do it and how much harassment those working people took. Right. They were taking the bold chance to stand up for themselves and their coworkers. So I'm looking at this, and it'll make this a million times easier for people to take that critical first step, reach out to a union and say, let's have some meetings and all of that. But I'll tell you one thing. If I was a boss and I was looking how the world was going right now, and I wanted a workforce that worked, stayed in the industry and worked hard, I'd be giving them whatever they wanted to get. All these employers are crying and complaining they can't get anybody to work. Well, pay a living wage. Mm-hmm. Treat your workers with respect and dignity. You'll get some people to work. And I think that that's like really a thing that they don't understand, that they, as Willie, every single building in this country was built by working people. I heard that yesterday. It's like workers are lazy. Lazy? We do all the work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They steal all the money and they go to Mars with it. So that enough of that. That's we got to change that.
Right. And Mark, just a few more questions. Another point is that been dogging the working class movement is how the employers and the capitalists kind of divide workers.
Yep.
All kinds of ways, So how do you think that this act will help us in the fight for racial and gender equality?
It's a great question, and there's so many divisions amongst working people. Right, there are ones between race, and they've been exploited over the years. There's ones between gender. Women are taking our jobs. African Americans are taking our jobs. All that kind of crap. When it's actually no factory that I've ever worked in that's went out of business was closed down by a woman or an African-American or Latino or Asian person or anything like that. They were closed down by white capitalists who closed them down
right.
and moved to other countries for more money. I used to be a cutter in the garment industry. I ain't any longer. It doesn't exist here. So, and it wasn't closed down by immigrants. So there's those divisions. There's the divisions between skilled workers and unskilled workers. How many times you tell we're paying burger flippers $15 an hour? That those kinds of prejudice that are passed into the working class, and then between workers that are working and workers that are unemployed. So there's all of that kind of stuff happening constantly amongst it. The best way for people to learn about one another and to stand in solidarity with one another, I believe, is in a union. My first experience is, I come from a town that was not the most diverse town in the world. And when I moved and joined a union for the first time when I was a kid, and I was working with people from everywhere, it was like the United Nations, and I was like learning and growing and changing because of the people that I worked with. And I believe that those things, if we could get into unions and we could be in that situation, that a lot of those things would break down over time in the struggle for a better life for all of our people. A fight for human rights, a fight for dignity for all, and I believe in a union, that's like sort of the best way that we could go about doing this. And I think that we're getting closer to that day than we've ever been. In the United States of America. Yeah. I think that there's a lot of people that will tell you the opposite of that. Well, when I was a kid watching civil rights demonstrations, the overwhelming majority of people in those demonstrations were African-American people. Very few and far between did you see white people being in those demonstrations, a small percentage. In fact, when you did see white people at a civil rights demonstration, they were throwing rocks usually at the people in the demonstration or beating them on the bridge. So nowadays, when you watch a civil rights demonstration, half of the people going to it are white people. Young people, like, for instance, my daughter, who's been going to some of these demonstrations, who's sick of living in a world of racism and doesn't want to live in that world any longer. And I think we got a better shot at making a new world where human rights are possible for each and every one of us. And solidarity is the name of it's how we live our lives, how we'll move forward as a and maybe survive as a species even, is through solidarity, starting with labor solidarity and moving to union, human solidarity, where human beings can finally flourish. And I believe that day's closer now than it's ever been. And I think that if we keep working together and listening to one another, that we'll get there. And when that day comes, if I'm still around on the planet, which, you know, I ain't a spring chicken anymore, Willie, you know that. When that day comes, that'll be a great day to get up in the morning, because all of this hatred that and all of the terror that African Americans have had to endure in this life, in this country, well, that'll be over, and we can start building a world where human beings can flourish rather than people who have enough money that they can take a ride into space for $28 million for 10 seconds or 10 minutes, whatever it was. why you got billionaires going to the stars, and you got a million people in the United States families living in their cars.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine's roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaking with Mark Emanation, director of the Capital District Area Labor Federation, the CDALF.
Up next, we have Devin Robinson, who recently joined the Sanctuary for Independent Media as a new Nature Lab community science coordinator. We spoke with Devin about building a community science space that is welcoming to the neighborhood.
Joining us today on Hudson Mohawk Magazine is Devin Robinson, one of the recent additions to the Sanctuary for Independent Media staff. Devin is one of the new Nature Lab community science coordinators. Welcome to the team.
Thank you, Sina. I appreciate being here. It's a great time, yeah.
We've been talking about Nature Lab, but for the listeners who don't know about Nature Lab, could you give a brief summary about what it is?
Yeah, of course. So Nature Lab is a new installation here in Troy, in northern Troy, partnership with the Sanctuary for Independent Media. It is a lab that's focused on community-based science and investigating the environment that is in central and north Troy. It functions basically on participatory science, so we're getting people in the community involved, as well as students and youth that are able to really provide an outstanding opportunity for them in that regard.
So how do you bring the youth into a science space?
So I think one of the best things about science is it has this natural curiosity to it. There are always people that are learning. To learn about your own world in science is a really great opportunity. I think that getting kids excited about science is seen like it might be difficult, but when it really comes down to it, if you're doing something that's engaging, that's real and authentic to them, you can really pull them in and have a huge impact. I see this in my classroom as well as in other classrooms at Troy High where I work. So it's a really great way to connect people to the earth, to their community, and then to also foster that curiosity and build on that intellectual component. But if kids are doing stuff, they're having fun, they're going to be there. They're going to be engaged. They're going to be doing it.
So you mentioned your classroom. What is your background? Where are you teaching? And how do you engage kids in the classroom?
Yes. So I currently work at Troy High School. I'm a biology and zoology teacher. This is the first year of our zoology curriculum, which I wrote last year. So a little bit different with COVID. The best way to really engage kids is to, like I said, get them doing something, doing hands-on learning. you know, whether that's labs or working with professionals in the field, or one of the projects we did was designing a museum exhibit for the Albany State Museum, the New York State Museum.
Oh, cool.
And the kids really loved that. They were able to speak with one of the curators there, and she actually evaluated their projects and they presented to them digitally. And after, they ended up saying that they were going to be building a new exhibit in the museum, just by coincidence, and that they were going to take my students' work and projects into consideration in the construction of the exhibit. So that real component to students, making it authentic, showing the effects, and then also that stem from possible careers in the field of science is a huge way to pull them in and keep them engaged. And I know that that's been one of the critiques of school, is that kids are sometimes bored and they don't enjoy what they're doing. So we have to find ways to make material enjoyable, but then also address all of the learning standards and outcomes that are expected by us as teachers.
It's interesting that you say that people claim that science is hard to engage students. When I think about science, I think of it similarly to art, and it's one of the first ways that kids really engage with the world, using a ball, touching leaves, exploring nature. Do you think that that is missing in the science curriculum, is really connecting real world to sciences?
I think that there has been a disconnect in the past. More recently, with the utilization of the NGSS science standards, these new science standards that are coming to New York State, there is this application of engineering, which is a new and kind of cutting edge piece to a science curriculum. It ensures kids they're actually doing hands-on work, they're building something, they're constructing something. And I agree with you. I feel art and science go hand in hand in that regard, where, you know, science and art can both be tools for one another. I mean, whether if it's something as simple as doing a poster board, you know, what is your art or, you know, design layout for that, as to, you know, science is what material are you putting on that? And then up to further to the use of technology and using modeling and 3D modeling, you know, there's a lot of art and design that goes into that, but then a lot of engineering and science as well.
So what are some of the projects that you have planned for Nature Lab?
Yeah. So right now we have two really exciting projects, a soil justice project, which is all about soil testing and contaminants in soil in the community. It's something that we often overlook. You know, we think like, oh yeah, that dirt's okay, that's great to play in. And now knowing the contaminants, whether they're arsenic, lead, copper, they can be a huge problem to our young people and to the community.
And that is part of the Our Soil project?
Yes, the Our Soil project.
And they are looking for fellows, right?
Yes.
There's a paid fellowship opportunity?
Yes, and we're actively looking for more fellows. If you care about your community, you know, it's your community. It's something that's super important, and we want to make sure we preserve the natural resources in this area. And I feel like the Our Soil project is a great segue to do that.
How do you test soil, and how easy is it to do?
Yes, so we have a couple really talented chemists and lead researchers that are taking this project and doing outstanding work with it. The reactions that they use for doing the three types of soil testing, the lead, arsenic, and copper, are somewhat complex, but not too difficult to where, you know, as long as you're able to follow a 5 or 6 step directions, they would be able to do it at home with very little issue. We've also run the idea by of having people bring their soil to the Nature Lab and us testing it there and then showing them the exemplar of how to do it and then them being able to go out in the community and do it as well. One of the reactions, the copper test is a redox oxidation reaction. So how that works is it's essentially a replacement. So what happens is you put a nail into a solution and then the copper begins to precipitate onto the nail and grow on the nail. And that's how we can tell if there's copper in the soil. The lead test is a color-based test, and the arsenic test is a color-based test with a gas component that is kept in a chamber.
Sounds like art.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It is beautiful to watch, but it's also eerily frightening to learn, like, wow, this bright pink is so great, but it's actually, you know, toxic. So, but
it's kind of like the water. The more it glows, the cooler it looks, yes. But the dirtier it is.
Yes. So
you mentioned a second project. So you're doing the soil testing, Our Soil project. Mm-hmm. What is the second project you're working on?
So we're testing water quality all over the Hudson River with River Caper through DEC. It is a great project. We have some outstanding scientists working with us and a few very talented, very eager and curious fellows that are doing outstanding work. They're very committed to what they're doing. And at our grand opening of the Nature Lab last week, We actually had citizen scientists bringing in water samples from all over the Hudson River and the Capital Region for us to be able to test them for bacteria in the water. It's an interesting way to see, you know, how is our pollution running off into the Hudson? What are the effects? And the Hudson has an incredible history to it. It's an incredible resource that most of us depend on. And it's something that, you know, impacts everyone, even if we don't live right on the river.
Is there a place to find the results for the soil testing and water testing?
There will be, yes. We will have the results posted on Nature Lab's website, I believe.
Great.
And the soil testing is going to be done individually. So I believe we'll catalog those results in a database. And then from there, people will be able to see where and what's going on.
Great. What is your hope for Nature Lab? How would you like to see it grow and be more available to the community?
So I think Nature Lab is in a unique position where it has this beautiful opportunity to have a huge impact, not just here in Troy, in North and Central Troy, but also in the larger Capital Region and all the way down into the Bay in New York. This is the tip of the Hudson River estuary, so we do have species moving up through the river and moving back down and migrating frequently. And I think Nature Lab is a great place for people to learn about that, as well as to take part of their community and have some positive change. I gave a presentation recently to some of the directors at the Nature Lab, and in it I had a picture of a whale in front of the Statue of Liberty. Whale sightings in New York City have gone up 540% in the past 8 years. And what that's been directly attributed to is the Clean Air and Water Act, less pollution into the Hudson River, and then also more control of the pollutants in the Hudson River where we are here today. We often think that, you know, the river is just here in Troy, but it moves all the way through southern New York and out into the ocean. So it's interesting when we talk about ecology to see how the small impacts here we have in Troy and the river and also in the Capital Region can have a huge impact to everything down and everything out into the ocean. It's a powerful message. And I think that, you know, when we look at small little microinvertebrates in the water, you know, it's easily overlooked. But when we look at a whale in a bay, it's a sigil for, you know, conservation and nature and preserving the environment. And I think that Nature Lab, the curriculum we're designing, the way we're looking at building the process here is going to have a huge impact in the environment and then also for the community and the youth in Troy. I think it's a great opportunity, and I'm very excited to be part of the team. I have some big lofty dreams, and I hope I can complete them. It'll definitely be an adventure, and I'm excited to be on it.
That was my interview with Devin Robinson, Nature Lab Community Science Coordinator. And he mentioned our soil project, and this week, as part of our Uptown Summer Program, the youth will be testing the soil that they collected last week to learn more about our soil and Water Justice Lab. You can find more of that on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
HMM producer Lizzie Kramer spoke with Liz Zunan, a local artist, about her experience in public art, children's book illustrating, and use of history in her work. The conversation takes place at Liz's latest mural in the Blake Annex co-working space in downtown Albany.
My name is Lizzie Kramer. I'm here with Liz Zunan at her mural in Albany, which depicts the historic Blake couple, and we're going to be talking about public art and its historic roots in Liz's work.
My name is Liz Zunan. I'm a children's book illustrator and author, and I also paint a lot of murals and make a lot of jewelry and think about chocolate, and I do a lot of presentations in classrooms and libraries also.
And how did you get into this work?
Well, I feel like all of the work that I've done that's connected with public art has been through the children's book illustration that I've done. So I studied illustration, and I decided that I really wanted to participate in creating images, positive images of Black people, brown people, multicultural families, reflecting like the multicultural world that we live in books. So I've had the opportunity to illustrate a lot of really interesting and important diverse children's books. So a lot of my books have been in local schools and libraries. And I've connected with a lot of local arts organizations around here. And that is how I connected with Tony Idacico from the Albany Center Gallery. And he is always looking for artists to participate in the different project, awesome projects that he's got cooking. So he connected me with the United Way of the Greater Capital Region, who was looking for someone to add some color to this co-working space, which is four white walls and a couple of windows and a couple of doorways. So I learned a little bit about the history of the building, the history about the couple that I was going to be painting, Adam Blake Jr. and his wife, Catherine Blake. And yeah, it was a great opportunity for me to kind of get out of my home studio. Usually I'm working by myself on at my desk at home on a very small scale when I'm working on books, but this was a fun project to get me out of the house and kind of institute some of the local history that I learned painting these portraits of these really interesting and important African-American icons of industry here in Albany.
Could you tell me a bit about them?
Adam Blake Jr., he was the son of Adam Blake Sr., who was an enslaved person that worked in the Albany area at the Van Rensselaer Mansion. So he grew up the son of a slave, but he was able to get an education when he was young. And he learned also a lot about the hospitality industry, working in local restaurants in the capital region. So he decided that he wanted to open a couple of different restaurants and hotels around here. So he is actually responsible for a lot of the development of downtown Albany. So he opened, he built and opened the Kenmore Hotel, which is adjacent to the building that we're in right now. And he ran it with his wife, Catherine. Unfortunately, he only lived, I think, about 2 years into his running of the Kenmore Hotel. He passed away, and then his wife, Catherine, continued to run the hotel very successfully. And it was, you know, a very unique thing for a Black couple to be so financially successful in the 1880s, 1870s and 1880s here in Albany. And they were able to garner a lot of respect from a lot of different communities around here. So the United Way wanted to honor this couple, the Blakes, by naming this room, this building, the Blake Annex, and have someone paint their portraits. Unfortunately, there is a lot known about their lives, but there aren't any photographs of them or engravings of them or sculptures or any depictions of what they might have looked like. So I kind of had to use my artist hat to think about what they would have looked like and try to come up with two portraits that might fit what they would have appeared like.
And does your work usually incorporate a historical component?
Yeah, my work is usually focused on portraiture. A lot of the books that I've illustrated for children are biographies about real people. So I do a lot of research where I look at a lot of historical photographs and other artwork that has been created to depict particular people. And sometimes the books that I illustrate are about people for which there are not a lot of photos, so I can kind of make up in my mind what they might have looked like. So this is one of the similar instances where I didn't know at all what they might have looked like. So I thought about, you know, what might I want to see if I saw, you know, a powerful Black couple in the 1880s? How would I depict them?
And how did you originally get into children's book illustrating?
Yeah, well, let's see. I was always interested in children's books when I was a kid. I was born here in Albany, but I grew up in the Ivory Coast, West Africa, where the official language is French. So my mom is American, my dad is Ivorian. So when we were living over there, my mom wanted to make sure that myself and my brother could both speak and read English as well as French. So my mom read a lot of bedtime stories to us that were American books, English language books. So I also always had a lot of kids' books in on my shelf, no matter where I was living. And when I came back to the States just before I turned 13, I attended Gilderland High School and I took a lot of art classes. And I decided at the end of high school, I really want to try to see if I could focus on art and drawing and painting and see if I can find a career doing this. So I studied at the Rhode Island School of Design, got a bachelor's degree. And after college, I submitted my art portfolio to a lot of book publishers in New York. And then eventually met my agent, who was able to get me my very first book contract. So I think it's my art portfolio that reflected my childhood living abroad in a hot tropical place where people are a lot of different varied skin tones, that was able to get me a lot of books that reflect that same thing as well.
How you've seen people receive your books, or how you're ideal for them to receive them is?
Yeah, I feel like it's such a different experience for someone to receive a book or have an experience with a book kind of one-on-one. You know, maybe a child sits on their parent's lap reading a book, turning the pages, asking questions, and it's a very intimate experience. But then painting something on a wall in the public for, you know, anybody that walks by to experience kind of makes me think a little bit differently about my artwork. No matter what I paint, I want the people to experience it in a way that gives them positivity and also opens up their mind to questions, opens up their mind to history or the possibilities of whatever I'm depicting. And I always want either the reader of the book that I'm illustrating or writing, or a passerby that walks by one of my murals, to see some aspect of their own life or their own self reflected in what's painted. Whether they might see, you know, a portrait on the wall painted thinking, oh, that guy looks like my dad, or that guy looks like my brother. Or it could be as simple as like, oh, I really like turquoise. I like the fact that you use turquoise in this painting. So I always want somebody to find something that they can identify with in the artwork.
What have you felt like the big differences between public art and your book art?
I would say with public art, I get a lot more feedback about what the people experience when they see it. With art for books, I have a lot of books out there, but I don't know what the individual experience is for the people that are reading the books. But usually if I'm painting something in the public, I get to interact with the people walking by. Mm-hmm. And we get to start a conversation and get to know each other. And that's not the case when I illustrate a book and it's just out there and I almost have nothing to do with it after I finish working on it.
Do any of those conversations of people walking by while you're painting like stand out?
I feel like when I am out painting something and someone walks by, oftentimes they will ask if I'm painting myself or depicting myself, or they'll say, oh, you're painting a portrait. Whatever you're painting looks like you. And that's not something that I try to do when I'm painting, but oftentimes some of my characters do end up looking like me just because I guess I'm used to my face.
What public art does for you and sort of what some of your inspirations may have been.
The Sistine Chapel and Michelangelo as kind of like one of the first public artists, painting with paintbrushes. I always paint with a paintbrush and making something, you know, that was one of a kind for the world to see.
Is there anything else you would like to add about sort of public art or the community that you work in?
Let's see. Well, I feel like there's a lot of really artistic and creative people in the Capital Region. And I feel like you never know what kind of cool art project is going to pop around just around the corner. When I was working on this project, I went to a new store in the neighborhood to buy some lunch, and there was really cool graffiti art on the walls. And I was like, oh my God, I never would have expected that, you know, in the corner store, I could be inspired by a beautiful piece of artwork. So there's just so much art popping up around here, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Lizzie Kramer speaking with Liz Zunan, and you can see her artwork or her books on her website at LizZunon.com.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dulcinea.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, also your engineer. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org/stories, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.